At any rate, his gaze had been directed there at the ceiling, whether he had been seeing it or not. Tengo closed his eyes and tried to imagine himself slowly moving toward death. But for a 30-year-old in good health, death was something far off, beyond the imagination. Instead, breathing softly, he watched the twilight shadows as they moved across the wall. He tried not to think about anything. Not thinking about anything was not too hard for Tengo. He was too tired to keep any one particular thought in his head. He wanted to catch some sleep if he could, but he was overtired and sleep wouldn't come. Just before 6 p.m., Nurse Omura came and told him dinner was ready in the cafeteria. Tengo had no appetite, but the tall, busty nurse wouldn't leave him alone. "You need to get something, even a little bit, into your stomach," she told him. This was close to a direct order. When it came to telling people how to maintain their health, she was a pro. And Tengo wasn't the type, especially when the other person was an older woman, who could resist. They took the stairs down to the cafeteria and found Kumi Adachi waiting for them. Nurse Tamura was nowhere to be seen. Tengo ate dinner at the same table as Kumi and Nurse Omura. Tengo had a salad, cooked vegetables, and miso soup with asari clams and scallions, washed down with hot hojicha tea. "When is the cremation?" Kumi asked him. "Tomorrow afternoon at 1, Tengo said. "When that's done, I'll probably go straight back to Tokyo. I have to go back to work."
"Will anyone else be at the cremation besides you, Tengo?"
"Nope, no one else, just me."
"Do you mind if I join you?" Kumi asked.
"At my father's cremation?" Tengo asked, surprised.
"Yes. Actually, I was pretty fond of him."
Tengo involuntarily put his chopsticks down and looked at her. Was she really talking about his father? "What did you like about him?" he asked her.
"He was very conscientious, never said more than he needed to," she said. "In that sense, he was like my father, who passed away."
"Huh," Tengo said.
"My father was a fisherman. He died before he reached 50.
"Did he die at sea?"
"No, he died of lung cancer. He smoked too much. I don't know why, but fishermen are all heavy smokers. It's like smoke is rising out of their whole body."
Tengo thought about this. "It might have been better if my father had been a fisherman, too."
"Why do you think that?"
"I'm not really sure," Tengo replied. "The thought just occurred to me, that it would have been better for him than being an NHK fee collector."
"If your father had been a fisherman, would it have been easier for you to accept him?"
"It would have made many things simpler, I suppose." Tengo pictured himself as a child, early in the morning on a day when he didn't have school, heading off on a fishing boat with his father. The stiff Pacific wind, the salt spray hitting his face, the monotonous drone of the diesel engine, the stuffy smell of the fishing nets. Hard, dangerous work. One mistake and you could lose your life. But compared with being dragged all over Ichikawa to collect subscription fees, it would have to be a more natural, fulfilling life.
"But collecting NHK fees couldn't have been very easy work, could it?"
Nurse Omura said as she ate her soy-flavored fish. "Probably not," Tengo said. At least he knew it wasn't the kind of job he could handle.
"Your father was really good at his job, wasn't he?" Kumi asked.
"I think he was, yes," Tengo said.
"He showed me his award certificates," Kumi said. "Ah, darn," Nurse Omura said, suddenly putting down her chopsticks. "I totally forgot. Darn it! How could I forget something so important? Could you wait here for a minute? I have something I have to give you, and it has to be today."
Nurse Omura wiped her mouth with a napkin, stood up, and hurried out of the cafeteria, her meal half eaten.
"I wonder what's so important," Kumi said, tilting her head.
Tengo had no idea. As he waited for Nurse Omura's return, he dutifully worked his way through his salad. There weren't many others eating dinner in the cafeteria. At one table, there were three old men, none of them speaking. At another table, a man in a white coat with a sprinkling of gray hair sat alone, reading the evening paper as he ate, a solemn look on his face. Nurse Omura finally trotted back. She was holding a department store shopping bag. She took out some neatly folded clothes.
"I got this from Mr. Kawana about a year or so ago, while he was still conscious," the large nurse said. "He said when he was put in the casket, he would like to be dressed in this. so I sent it to the cleaners and had them store it in mothballs. There was no mistaking the NHK fee collector's uniform. The matching trousers had been nicely ironed. The smell of mothballs hit Tengo. For a while, he was speechless.
"Mr. Kawana told me he would like to be cremated wearing this uniform," Nurse Omura said.
She refolded the uniform neatly and put it back in the shopping bag.
"So I'm giving it to you now. Tomorrow, give this to the funeral home people and make sure they dress him in it."
"Isn't it a problem to have him wear this? The uniform was just on loan to him, and when he retired it should have been returned to NHK," Tengo said, weakly.
"I wouldn't worry about it," Kumi said. "If we don't say anything, who's going to know? NHK isn't going to be in a tight spot over a set of old clothes."
Nurse Omura agreed.
"Mr. Kawana walked all over the place, from morning to night, for over 30 years for NHK. I'm sure it wasn't always pleasant. Who cares about one uniform? It's not like you're using it to do something bad or anything."
"You're right. I still have my school uniform from high school," Kumi said.
"An NHK collector's uniform and a high school uniform aren't exactly the same thing," Tengo interjected, but no one took up the point.
"Come to think of it, I have my old school uniform in the closet somewhere, too," Nurse Omura said.
"Are you telling me you put it on sometimes for your husband, along with white bobby socks?" Kumi said teasingly.
"Hmm, now that's a thought," Nurse Omura said, her chin in her hands on the table, her expression serious.
"Probably get him all hot and bothered."
"Anyway," Kumi said. She turned to Tengo. "Mr. Kawana definitely wanted to be cremated in his NHK uniform. I think we should help him make his wish come true. Don't you think so?"
Tengo took the bag containing the uniform and went back to the room. Kumi Adachi came with him and made up the bed. There were fresh sheets with a still starchy fragrance, a new blanket, a new bed cover, and a new pillow. Once all this was arranged, the bed his father had slept in looked totally transformed. Tengo randomly thought of Kumi's thick, luxuriant pubic hair.
"Your father was in a coma for so long," Kumi said as she smoothed out the wrinkles in the sheets, "but I don't think he was completely unconscious."
"Why do you say that?" Tengo asked.
"Well, he would sometimes send messages to somebody."
Tengo was standing at the window, gazing outside, but he spun around and looked at Kumi.
"Messages?" "He would tap on the bed frame. His hand would hang down from the bed, and he would knock on the frame, like he was sending Morse code. Like this."
Kumi lightly tapped the wooden bed frame with her fist.
"Don't you think it sounds like a signal?"
"That's not a signal."
"Then what is it?"
"He's knocking on a door," Tengo said, his voice dry.
"The front door of a house."
"I guess that makes sense. It does sound like someone knocking on a door." She narrowed her eyes to slits.
"So are you saying that even after he lost consciousness, he was still making his rounds to collect fees?"
"Probably," Tengo said, "somewhere inside his head."
"It's like that story of the dead soldier still clutching his trumpet," Kumi said, impressed.
There was nothing to say to this, so Tengo stayed silent.
"Your father must have really liked his job, going around collecting NHK subscription fees."
"I don't think it's a question of liking or disliking it," Tengo said.
"Then what?"
"It was the one thing he was best at."
"Hmm, I see," Kumi said.
She pondered this.
"But that might very well be the best way to live your life."
"Maybe so," Tengo said, as he looked out at the pine windbreak. "It might really be so."
"What's the one thing you can do best?"
"I don't know," Tengo said, looking straight at her.
"I honestly have no idea."
Chapter 22. Ushikawa. Those eyes looked rather full of pity. Tengo showed up at the entrance to the apartment building on Sunday evening at 6:15. As soon as he stepped outside, he halted and gazed around as if looking for something. First to the right, then the left, then from left to right. He looked up at the sky, then down at his feet. But nothing seemed to be out of the ordinary as far as he was concerned. Ushikawa didn't follow him then. Tengo was carrying nothing with him. His hands were stuffed in the pockets of his unpleated chinos. He had on a high-neck sweater and a well-worn olive-green corduroy jacket, and his hair was unruly. A thick paperback book peeped out of a jacket pocket. Ushikawa figured he must be going out to dinner in a nearby restaurant. Fine, he decided.
Just let him go where he wants.
Tengo had several classes he had to teach on Monday. Ushikawa had found this out by phoning the cram school. Yes, a female office worker had told him. Mr. Kawana will be teaching his regular classes from the beginning of the week. Good. From tomorrow, then, Tengo was finally going back to his normal schedule. Knowing him, he probably wouldn't be going far this evening. If Ushikawa had followed him that night, he would have found out that Tengo was on his way to meet with Komatsu at the bar in Yotsuya. Just before 8, Ushikawa threw on his pea coat, muffler, and a knit hat, and looking around him as he did, hurried out of the building. Tengo had not yet returned at this point. If he was really eating somewhere in the neighborhood, it was taking longer than it should. If Ushikawa was unlucky, he might actually bump into him on his way back, but he was willing to run the risk, since there was something he absolutely had to do, and it had to be done now, at this time of night. He relied on his memory of the route as he turned several corners, passed a few semi-familiar-looking landmarks, and though he hesitated a few times, unsure of the direction, he eventually arrived at the playground. The strong north wind of the previous day had died down, and it was warm for a December evening, but as expected, the park was deserted. Ushikawa double-checked that there was no one else around, then climbed up the slide. He sat down on the top of the slide, leaned back against the railing, and looked up at the sky. The moons were there, almost in the same location as the night before. A bright moon, two-thirds full, not a single cloud nearby, and beside it, a small, green, misshapen moon snuggled close. So it's no mistake, then, Ushikawa thought. He exhaled and shook his head. He wasn't dreaming or hallucinating. Two moons, one big, one small, were definitely visible there, above the leafless Zelkova tree. The two moons looked like they had stayed put since last night, waiting for him to return to the top of the slide. They knew that he would be back. As if prearranged, the silence around them was suggestive, and the moons wanted Ushikawa to share that silence with them. "You can't tell anybody else about this," they warned. They held an index finger, covered with a light dusting of ash, to their mouths to make sure he didn't say a thing. As he sat there, Ushikawa moved his facial muscles this way and that to make sure there wasn't something unnatural or unusual about this feeling he was having. He found nothing unnatural about it. For better or for worse, this was his normal face. Ushikawa always saw himself as a realist, and he actually was. Metaphysical speculation wasn't his thing. If something really existed, you had to accept it as a reality, whether or not it made sense or was logical. That was his basic way of thinking. Principles and logic didn't give birth to reality. Reality came first, and the principles and logic followed. So, he decided, he would have to begin by accepting this reality, that there were two moons in the sky. The rest of it he would think about later. He sat there, trying not to think, completely absorbed in observing the two moons. He tried to get used to the scene. "I have to accept these guys as they are," he said to himself. He couldn't explain why something like this could be possible, but it wasn't a question he needed to delve into deeply at this point. The question was how to deal with it. That was the real issue. To do so, he needed to start by accepting what he was seeing without questioning the logic of it. Ushikawa was there for some 15 minutes. He sat, leaning against the railing of the slide, hardly moving a muscle, like a diver slowly acclimatizing his body to a change in water pressure. He let himself be bathed in the light from these moons, let it seep into his skin. Ushikawa's instinct told him this was important. Finally, this small man with a misshapen head stood up, climbed down from the slide, and, completely caught up in indescribable musings, walked back to the apartment building. Things looked a little different from when he came.
Maybe it's the moonlight, he told himself. That moonlight is gradually displacing how things appear.
Thanks to this, he took the wrong turn a number of times. Before he walked inside the building, he looked up at the third floor to check that Tengo's lights were still off. Tengo was still out. It didn't seem likely that he had just gone out to eat someplace nearby. Maybe he was meeting somebody. And maybe that somebody was Aomame, or Fukaeri.
Have I let a golden opportunity slip through my fingers? He wondered.
But it was too late to worry about it now. It was too risky to tail Tengo every time he went out. Tengo only had to spot him once to bring the whole operation crashing down. Ushikawa went back to his apartment and removed his coat, muffler, and hat. He opened a tin of corned beef, spread some on a roll, and ate it, standing up in the kitchen. He drank a container of lukewarm canned coffee. Nothing had any taste. He could feel the texture of the food, but he couldn't taste anything. Whether this was the fault of the food and drink or his own sense of taste, he couldn't say. Maybe it could be blamed on those two moons. He heard a faint doorbell ring somewhere. A pause. Then it rang again. He didn't care. It wasn't his chime ringing, but somebody else's far away on a different floor. He finished his sandwich, drained the coffee, then leisurely smoked a cigarette to bring his mind back to reality. He reconfirmed what it was he had to do here and sat down behind the camera at the window. He switched on the electric space heater and warmed his hands in front of the orange light. It was Sunday evening, not yet 9. Traffic into and out of the building was sparse, but Ushikawa was determined to see what time Tengo returned. A moment later, a woman in a black down jacket came out of the entrance, a woman he had never seen before. She had on a gray muffler up to her mouth, dark framed glasses, and a baseball cap, the perfect get-up to hide yourself from prying eyes. She was empty-handed and was walking briskly, taking long strides. Instinctively, Ushikawa switched on the camera's motor drive and snapped 3 quick shots. He had to find out where she was going. But by the time he had gotten to his feet, the woman had reached the road and vanished into the night. Ushikawa frowned and gave up. At the pace she was walking, by the time he got his shoes on and chased after her, it would be too late to catch up. He did an instant replay in his mind of what he had just seen. The woman was about 5 feet 6 inches tall and wore narrow blue jeans and white sneakers. All her clothes looked strangely brand new. He would put her at mid-20s to about 30. Her hair was stuffed in her collar, so he couldn't tell how long it was. The puffy down jacket made it hard to tell what sort of figure she had, but judging from her legs, she must be fairly slim. Her good posture and quick pace indicated she was young and healthy. She must be into sports. All these characteristics fit the Aomame that Ushikawa knew about, though he couldn't make too many assumptions. Still, she seemed to be very cautious. You could tell how tense her whole body was, like an actress being stalked by paparazzi. Let's suppose for the moment, he thought, that this was Aomame. She came here to see Tengo, but Tengo was out somewhere. The lights in his place were off. She came to see him, but there was no answer when she knocked, so she gave up and left. Maybe she was the one who had been ringing the doorbell. But something about this didn't make sense. Aomame was being pursued and should be trying to stay out of sight. Why wouldn't she have called Tengo ahead of time to make sure he would be at home? That way she wouldn't unnecessarily expose herself to danger.
Ushikawa mulled this over as he sat in front of the camera, but he couldn't come up with a working hypothesis that made any sense. The woman's actions, disguising herself in this non-disguise, leaving the place where she was hiding, didn't fit what Ushikawa knew about her. She was more cautious and careful than that. The whole thing left him befuddled. Anyhow, he decided he would go to the photo shop near the station tomorrow and develop the film he had taken. This mystery woman should be in the photos. He kept watch with his camera until past 10, but after the woman left, no one else came in or out of the building. The entrance was silent and deserted, like a stage abandoned after a poorly attended performance. Ushikawa was puzzled about Tengo. As far as he knew, he rarely stayed out this late, and he had classes to teach tomorrow. Maybe he had already come home while Ushikawa was out, and had long since gone to bed. After 10, Ushikawa realized how exhausted he was. He could barely keep his eyes open. This was unusual since he normally kept late hours. Usually he could stay up as late as he needed. But tonight, sleep was bearing down on him from above, like the stone lid of an ancient coffin. "Maybe I looked at those two moons for too long," he thought. "Absorbed too much of their light?" Their vague afterimage remained in his eyes. Their dark silhouettes numbed the soft part of his brain, like a bee stinging and numbing a caterpillar, then laying eggs on the surface of its body. The bee larva used the paralyzed caterpillar as a convenient source of food and devour it as soon as they're born. Ushikawa frowned and shook this ominous image from his mind. "Fine," he decided. "I can't wait here forever for Tengo to get back. When he gets back is entirely up to him, and he'll just go to sleep as soon as he does. He doesn't have anywhere else to come back to besides this apartment, most likely." Ushikawa listlessly tugged off his trousers and sweater and stripped to his long-sleeved shirt and long johns, slipped into his sleeping bag. He curled up and soon fell asleep. It was a deep sleep, almost coma-like. As he was falling asleep, he thought he heard a knock at the door. But by then his consciousness had shifted over to another world, and he couldn't distinguish one thing from another. When he tried, his body creaked. So he kept his eyes shut, didn't try to figure out what the sound could mean, and once more sank down into the soft, muddy oblivion of sleep. It was about 30 minutes after Ushikawa fell into this deep sleep that Tengo came back home after meeting Komatsu. He brushed his teeth, hung up his jacket, which reeked of cigarette smoke, changed into pajamas, and went to sleep. Until a phone call came at 2 a.m. telling him that his father was dead. When Ushikawa awoke, it was past 8 a.m., Monday morning, and Tengo was already on the express train to Tateyama, fast asleep to make up for the hours he had missed. Ushikawa sat behind his camera, waiting to catch Tengo on his way to the cram school, but of course, he never made an appearance. At 1 p.m., Ushikawa gave up. He went to a nearby public phone and called the cram school to see if Tengo was teaching his regular classes today. "Mr. Kawana had a family emergency, so his classes are canceled for today," the woman on the phone said. Ushikawa thanked her and hung up. Family emergency? The only family Tengo had was his father. His father must have died. If that was the case, then Tengo would be leaving Tokyo again. "Maybe he had already left while I was sleeping. What was wrong with me? I slept so long, I missed him. At any rate, Tengo is now all alone in the world," thought Ushikawa. A lonely man to begin with, he was now even lonelier, utterly alone. Before he was even 2, his mother had been strangled to death at a hot springs resort in Nagano Prefecture. The man who murdered her was never caught. She had left her husband and, with Tengo in tow, had absconded with a young man. Absconded. A quite old-fashioned term, Nobody uses it anymore, but for a certain kind of action, it's the perfect term. Why the man killed her wasn't clear. It wasn't even clear if that man had been the one who murdered her. She had been strangled at night with the belt from her robe in a room at an inn. The man she had been with was gone. It was hard not to suspect him. When Tengo's father got the news, he came from Ichikawa and took back his infant son. Maybe I should have told Tengo about this, Ushikawa thought. He has a right to know. But he told me he didn't want to hear anything about his mother from the likes of me, so I didn't say anything. Well, what are you going to do? That's not my problem. It's his. At any rate, whether Tango's here or not, I have to keep up my surveillance of this place, Ushikawa told himself. Last night was that mysterious woman who looked a lot like Aomame. I have no proof it's her, but there's a strong possibility it is. That's what my misshapen head is telling me. And if that woman is Aomame, she'll be back to visit Tango before long. She doesn't know yet that his father has died. These were Ushikawa's deductions as he mulled over the situation. Tengo must have gotten the news about his father during the night and set off early this morning. And there must be some reason why the two of them couldn't get in touch by phone, which means she would definitely be coming back here. Something was so important to her that she would come here, despite the danger. This time he was going to find out where she was going. Doing so might also begin to explain why there were two moons. This was a fascinating question that Ushikawa was dying to solve. But really, it was of secondary importance. His job was to find out where Aomame was hiding and hand her over nice and neat to the creepy Sakigake duo. Until I do so, whether there are two moons or only one, he decided, I have to be realistic. That has always been my strong point. It's what defines me. Ushikawa went to the photo store near the station and handed over 5 36 exposure rolls of film. Once the film had been processed and printed, he went to a nearby chain restaurant and looked through them in chronological order while eating a meal of chicken curry. Most were photos of people he was now familiar with. There were three people he was most interested in, Fuka Eri and Tengo, and last night's mystery woman. Fuka Eri's eyes made him nervous. Even in the photo, she was staring straight into his face. No doubt about it, Ushikawa thought. She knew she was being observed. She probably knew about the hidden camera, too, and that he was taking photos. Her clear eyes saw through everything, and they didn't like what Ushikawa was up to. That unwavering gaze stabbed mercilessly into the depths of his heart. There was no excuse whatsoever for the activities he was engaged in. At the same time, though, she wasn't condemning him or despising him. In a sense, those gorgeous eyes forgave him. No, not forgiveness, Ushikawa decided, rethinking it. Those eyes pitied him. She knew how ugly Ushikawa's actions were, and she felt compassion for him. Compassion for him. Looking at her eyes, he had felt a sharp stab of pain between his ribs, as if a thick knitting needle had been thrust in. He felt like a twisted, ugly person. So what? He thought. I really am twisted and ugly. The natural, transparent pity that colored her eyes sank deep into his heart. He would have much preferred to be openly accused, reviled, denounced, and convicted. Much better even to be beaten senseless with a baseball bat. That he could stand. But not this. Compared with her, Tango was much easier to deal with. In the photo, he was standing at the entrance, also looking in his direction. Like Fuka Eri, he carefully examined his surroundings. but there was nothing in his eyes. Pure, ignorant eyes like those couldn't locate the camera hidden behind the curtains, or Ushikawa. Ushikawa turned to the photos of the mystery woman. There were three photos. Baseball cap, dark-framed glasses, gray muffler up to her nose. It was impossible to make out her features. The lighting was poor in all the photos, and the baseball cap cast a shadow over her face. Still, this woman perfectly fit his mental image of Aomame. He picked up the photos and, like checking out a poker hand, went through them in order, over and over. The more he looked at them, the more convinced he was that this had to be Aomame. He called the waitress over and asked her about the day's dessert. Peach pie, she replied. Ushikawa ordered a piece and a refill of coffee. If this isn't Aomame, he thought as he waited for the pie, then I might never see her as long as I live. The peach pie was much tastier than expected. Juicy peaches inside a crisp, flaky crust. Canned peaches, no doubt, but not too bad for a dessert at a chain restaurant. Ushikawa ate every last bite, drained the coffee, and left the restaurant feeling content. He picked up 3 days' worth of food at a supermarket, then went back to the apartment and his stakeout in front of the camera. As he continued his surveillance of the entrance, he leaned back against the wall in a sunny spot and dozed off a few times. This didn't bother him. He felt sure he hadn't missed anything important while he slept. Tango was away from Tokyo at his father's funeral, and Fuka Eri wasn't coming back. She knew he was continuing his surveillance. The chances were slim that the mystery woman would visit while it was light out. She would be cautious and wait until dark to make a move. But even after sunset, the mystery woman didn't appear. The same old lineup came and went, shopping bags in hand, out for an evening stroll, those coming back from work looking more beaten and worn out than when they had set off in the morning. Ushikawa watched them come and go, but didn't snap any photos. There wasn't any need. Ushikawa was focused on only three people. Everyone else was just a nameless pedestrian. But to pass time, Ushikawa called out to them, using the nicknames he had come up with. Hey, Chairman Mao. The man's hair looked like mousy tongues. You must have worked hard today. Warm today, isn't it, Long Ears? Perfect for a walk. Evening, Chinless. Shopping again? What's for dinner? Ushikawa kept up his surveillance until 11. He gave a big yawn and called it a day. After he brushed his teeth, he stuck out his tongue and looked at it in the mirror. It had been a while since he had examined his tongue. Something like moss was growing on it, a light green, like real moss. He examined this moss carefully under the light. It was disturbing. The moss adhered to his entire tongue and didn't look like it would come off easily. If I keep up like this, he thought, I'm going to turn into a moss monster. Starting with my tongue, green moss will spread here and there on my skin, like the shell of a turtle that lives in a swamp. The very thought was disheartening. He sighed and, in a voiceless voice, decided to stop worrying about his tongue. He turned off the light, slowly undressed in the dark, and snuggled into a sleeping bag. He zipped the bag and curled up like a bug. It was dark when he woke up. He turned to check the time, but his clock wasn't where it should be. This confused him. His long-standing habit was to always check for the clock before he went to sleep, so why wasn't it there? A faint light came in through a gap in the curtain, but it only illuminated a corner of the room. Everywhere else was wrapped in middle-of-the-night darkness. Ushikawa felt his heart racing, working hard to pump adrenaline through his system. His nostrils flared, his breathing was ragged, like he had woken in the middle of a vivid, exciting dream. But he wasn't dreaming. Something really was happening. Somebody was standing right next to him. Ushikawa could sense it. A shadow, darker than the darkness, was looming over him, staring down at his face. His back stiffened. In a fraction of a second, his mind regrouped, and he instinctively tried to unzip the sleeping bag. In the blink of an eye, the person wrapped his arm around Ushikawa's throat. He didn't even have time to get out a sound. Ushikawa felt a man's strong, trained muscles around his neck. This arm constricted his throat, squeezing him mercilessly in a vice-like grip. The man never said a word. Ushikawa couldn't even hear him breathing. He twisted and writhed in his sleeping bag, tearing at the inner nylon lining, kicking with both feet. He tried to scream, but even if he could, it wouldn't help. Once the man had settled down on the tatami, he didn't budge an inch except for his arm, which gradually increased the amount of force he applied. A very effective, economical movement. As he did, pressure grew on Ushikawa's windpipe, and his breathing grew weaker. In the midst of this desperate situation, what flashed through Ushikawa's mind was this. How had the man gotten in here? The door was locked, the chain inside set, the windows bolted shut. So how did he get in? If he picked the lock, it would have made a sound. This guy is a real pro. If the situation called for it, he wouldn't hesitate to take a person's life. He is trained precisely for this. Was he sent by Sakigake? Have they finally decided to get rid of me? Did they conclude that I was useless to them, a hindrance they had to get rid of? If so, they're flat out wrong. I'm one step away from locating Aomame. Ushikawa tried to speak, to tell the man this. Listen to me first, he wanted to plead. But no voice would come. There wasn't enough air to vibrate his vocal cords, and his tongue in the back of his mouth was a solid rock. Now his windpipe was completely blocked. His lungs desperately struggled for oxygen, but none was to be found, and he felt his body and mind split apart. His body continued to writhe inside the sleeping bag, but his mind was dragged off into the heavy, gooey air. He suddenly had no feeling in his arms and legs. Why? His fading mind asked. Why do I have to die? In such an ugly place, in such an ugly way. There was no answer. An undefined darkness descended from the ceiling and enveloped everything. When he regained consciousness, Ushikawa was no longer inside the sleeping bag. He couldn't feel his arms or legs. All he knew was that he had on a blindfold and his cheek felt pressed up against the tatami. He wasn't being strangled anymore. His lungs audibly heaved like bellows breathing in new air, cold winter air. The oxygen made new blood, and his heart pumped this hot red liquid to all his nerve endings at top speed. He coughed wretchedly and focused on breathing. Gradually, feeling was returning to his extremities. His heart pounded hard in his ears. I'm still alive, Ushikawa told himself in the darkness. Ushikawa was lying face down on the tatami. His hands were bound behind him, tied up in something that felt like a soft cloth. His ankles were tied up as well, not tied so tightly, but in an accomplished, effective way. He could roll from side to side, but that was all. Ushikawa found it astounding that he was alive, still breathing. So that wasn't death, he thought. It had come awfully close to death, but it wasn't death itself. A sharp pain remained like a lump on either side of his throat. He had urinated in his pants and his underwear was wet and starting to get clammy. But it wasn't such a bad sensation. In fact, he rather welcomed it. The pain and cold were signs that he was still alive.
You won't die that easily,
the man's voice said, like he had been reading Ushikawa's mind.
Chapter 23 Aomame. The light was definitely there. It was past midnight. The day had shifted from Sunday to Monday, but still sleep wouldn't come. Aomame finished her bath, put on pajamas, slipped into bed, and turned out the light. Staying up late wouldn't accomplish a thing. For the time being, she had left it all up to Tamaru. Much better to get some sleep and think again in the morning when her mind was fresh. But she was wide awake, and her body wanted to be up and moving. It didn't look like she would be getting to sleep any time soon. She gave up, got out of bed, and threw a robe over her pajamas. She boiled water, made herbal tea, and sat at the dining table, slowly sipping it. A thought came to her, but what it was exactly she couldn't say. It had a thick, furtive form, like far-off rain clouds. She could make out its shape, but not its outline. There was a disconnect of some kind between shape and outline. Mug in hand, she went over to the window and looked out at the playground through a gap in the curtains. There was no one there, of course. Past 1 a.m. now, the sandbox, swings, and slide were deserted. It was a particularly silent night. The wind had died down, and there wasn't a single cloud in the sky, just the two moons floating above the frozen branches of the trees. The position of the moons had shifted with the Earth's rotation, but they were still visible. Almama stood there, thinking about Bobblehead's run-down apartment building and the name card in the slot on the door of apartment 303. A white card with the typed name Kawana. The card wasn't new by any means. The edges were curled up, and there were faint moisture stains on it. The card had been in the slot for some time. Tamaru would find out for her if it was really Tengo Kawana who lived there, or someone else with the same last name. At the latest, he would probably report back by tomorrow. He wasn't the kind of person who wasted time. Then she would know for sure. Depending on the outcome, she thought, I might actually see Tengo before much longer. The possibility made it hard to breathe, like the air around her had suddenly gotten thin. But things might not work out that easily. Even if the person living in 303 was Tengo Kawana, Bobblehead was hidden away somewhere in the same building. And he was planning something. What, she didn't know, but it couldn't be good. He was undoubtedly hatching a clever plan, breathing down their necks, doing what he could to prevent them from seeing each other. No, there's nothing to worry about, Amame told herself. Tamaru can be trusted. He's more meticulous, capable, and experienced than anyone I know. If I leave it up to him, he will fend off Bobblehead for me. Bobblehead is a danger not just to me but to Tamaru as well, a risk factor that has to be eliminated. But what if Tamaru decides that it isn't advisable for Tengo and me to meet? Then what will I do? If that happens, then Tamaru will surely cut off any possibility of Tengo and me ever seeing each other. Tamaru and I are pretty friendly, but his top priority is what will benefit the Dowager and keep her out of harm's way. That's his real job. He isn't doing all this for my sake. This made her uneasy. Getting Tengo and her together, letting them see each other. Where did this fall on Tamaru's list of priorities? She had no way of knowing. Maybe telling Tamaru about Tengo had been a fatal mistake. Shouldn't I have taken care of everything myself? But what's done is done. I've told Tamaru everything. I had no choice. Bobblehead must be lying in wait for me. And it would be suicide to waltz right in all alone. Time is ticking away and I don't have the leisure to put things on hold and see how they might develop. Opening up to Tamaru about everything and putting it all in his hands was the best choice at the time. Almame decided to stop thinking about Tengo and stop looking at the moons. The moonlight wreaked havoc on her mind. It changed the tides and inlets, stirred up life in the woods. She drank the last of her herbal tea, left the window, went to the kitchen, and rinsed out the mug. She longed for a sip of brandy, but she knew she shouldn't have any alcohol while pregnant. She sat on the sofa, switched on the small reading lamp beside it, and began rereading Air Chrysalis. She had read the novel at least 10 times. It wasn't a long book, and by now she had nearly memorized it. But she wanted to read it again, slowly, attentively. She figured she might as well, since she wasn't about to get to sleep. There might be something in it she had overlooked. Air Chrysalis was like a book with a secret code, and Eriko Fukada must have told the story in order to get a message across. Tengo rewrote it, creating something more polished, more effective. They had formed a team to create a novel with a wider appeal. As Leader had said, it was a collaborative effort. If Leader was to be believed, when Air Chrysalis became a bestseller and certain secrets were revealed within, the little people lost their power, and the voice no longer spoke. Because of this, the well dried up, the flow was cut off. This is how much influence the novel had exerted. She focused on each line as she read. By the time the clock showed 2:30, she was already 2/3 of the way through the novel. She closed the book and tried to put into words the strong emotions she was feeling. Though she wouldn't go so far as to call it a revelation, she had a strong, specific image in her mind. I wasn't brought here by chance. This is what the image told her. I'm here because I'm supposed to be. Up until now, she thought, I believed I was dragged into this 1Q84 world, not by my own will. Something had intentionally engaged the switch so the train I was on was diverted from the mainline and entered this strange new world. Suddenly I realized I was here, a world of two moons, haunted by little people, where there is an entrance, but no exit. Leader had explained it this way just before he died. The train is a story that Tengo wrote, and I was trapped inside that tale, which explains exactly why I am here now. Entirely passive, a confused, clueless bit player wandering in a thick fog. But that's not the whole picture, Ah Mama told herself. That's not the whole picture at all. I am not just some passive being mixed up in this because someone else willed it. It might be partly true, but at the same time I chose to be here. I chose to be here of my own free will. She was sure of this. And there's a clear reason I'm here. One reason alone. So I can meet Tengo again. If you look at it the other way around, that's the only reason why this world is inside of me. Maybe it's a paradox, like an image reflected to infinity in a pair of facing mirrors. I am a part of this world, and this world is a part of me. There was no way for Ah Mama to know what sort of plot Tengo's new story contained. Most likely there were two moons in that world, and it was frequented by little people. That was about as far as she could speculate. This might be Tengo's story, she thought. But it's my story, too. This much she understood. She realized this when she got to the scene where the young girl, the protagonist, was working to create an air chrysalis every night in the shed with the little people. As she read through this detailed, clear description, she felt something warm and oozy in her abdomen, a sort of melting warmth with a strange depth. Though tiny, there was an intense heat source there. What that heat source was, and what it meant, was obvious to her. She didn't need to think about it. The little one. It was emitting heat in response to the scene in which the protagonist and the little people together weaved the air chrysalis. Al-Mamet put the book on the table next to her, unbuttoned her pajama top, and rested a hand on her belly. She could feel the heat being given off, almost like a dim orange light was there inside her. She switched off the reading lamp, and in the darkened bedroom, stared hard at that spot, a luminescence almost too faint to see. But the light was definitely there. No mistake about it. I am not alone. We are connected through this, by experiencing the same story simultaneously. And if that story is mine as well as Tango's, then I should be able to write the storyline too. I should be able to comment on what's there, maybe even rewrite part of it. I have to be able to. Most of all, I should be able to decide how it's going to turn out. Right? She considered the possibility. Okay, but how do I do it? Al-Mamet didn't know, though she knew it had to be possible. At this point, it was a mere theory. In the silent darkness, she pursed her lips and contemplated. This was critical, and she had to put her mind to it. The two of us are a team. Like Tengo and Eriko Fukada made up a brilliant team when they created Air Chrysalis, Tengo and I are a team for this new story. Our wills, or maybe some undercurrent of our wills, are becoming one, creating this complex story and propelling it forward. This process probably takes place on some deep, invisible level. Even if we aren't physically together, we are connected as one. We create the story, and at the same time, the story is what sets us in motion, right? But I have a question, a very important question. In this story that the two of us are writing, what could be the significance of this little one? What sort of role will it play? Inside my womb is a subtle yet tangible heat that is emitting a faint orange light. Exactly like an air chrysalis. Is my womb playing the role of an air chrysalis? Am I the Maza? And the little one my Dota? Is the little people's will involved in all this? In my being pregnant with Tengo's child, although we didn't have sex? Have they cleverly usurped my womb to use as an air chrysalis? Using me as a device to extract another new Dota? That's not what's going on. She was positive about it. That's not possible. The little people have lost their power. Leader said so. The popularity of the novel Air Chrysalis essentially blocked what they normally do. So they must not know about this pregnancy. But who, or what power, made this pregnancy possible? And why? Al-Mamet had no idea. What she did know was that this little one was something she and Tengo had formed, that it was a precious, priceless life. She placed her hand on her abdomen again, pressing gently against the outline of that faint orange glow. She let the warmth she felt there slowly permeate her whole body. "I've got to protect this little one, at all costs," she told herself. Nobody is ever going to take it away from me or harm it. The two of us have to keep it safe. In the darkness, she made up her mind. She went into the bedroom, took off her robe, and got into bed. She lay face up and once more touched her abdomen and felt the warmth there. Her feeling of unease was gone. She knew what had to be done. I have to be stronger, she told herself. My mind and body have to be one. Finally, sleep came. Silently, like smoke, and wrapped her in its embrace. Two moons were still floating in the sky, side by side.
Chapter 24. Tengo.
leaving the cat down. Tengo's father's corpse was dressed in his neatly ironed NHK fee collector's uniform and placed inside the simple coffin. Probably the cheapest coffin available, it was a sullen little casket that looked only slightly more sturdy than the boxes for Castella cakes. The deceased was a small person, yet there was barely any room to spare. The casket was made of plywood and had minimal ornamentation. "Is this casket all right?" the funeral director had asked, making sure. "It's fine," Tengo replied. This was the casket his father had chosen from the catalog for which he had prepaid. If the deceased had no problem with it, then neither did Tengo. Dressed in his NHK uniform, lying in the crude coffin, his father didn't look dead. He looked like he was taking a nap on a work break and would soon get up, put on his cap, and go out to collect the rest of the fees. The uniform, with the NHK logo sewed into it, looked like a second skin. He was born in this uniform and would leave this world in the same way as he went up in flames. When Tengo actually saw him in it, he couldn't imagine his father wearing anything else. Just like Wagner's warriors on their funeral pyre could only be dressed in armor. Tuesday morning, in front of Tengo and Kumi Adachi, the lid of the coffin was closed, nailed shut, then placed inside the hearse. It wasn't much of a hearse, just the same businesslike Toyota van they had used to transport his body to the funeral home. This hearse, too, must have been the cheapest available. Stately was the last word you would use to describe it, and there was certainly no Götterdämmerung music as a send-off. But Tengo couldn't find anything to complain about, and Kumi didn't seem to have any problems with it either. What was more important was that a person had vanished from the face of the earth, and those left behind had to grasp what that entailed. The two of them got into a taxi and followed the black van. They left the seaside road, drove a short way into the hills, and arrived at the crematorium. It was a relatively new building, but utterly devoid of individuality. It seemed less a crematorium than some sort of factory or government office building. The garden was lovely and well tended, though the tall chimney rising majestically into the sky hinted that this was a facility with a special mission. The crematorium must not have been very busy that day, since the casket was taken right away. The casket was gently laid inside the incinerator, then the heavy lid was shut, like a submarine hatch. The old man in charge, wearing gloves, turned and bowed to Tengo, then hit the ignition switch. Kumi turned to the closed lid and put her hands together in prayer, and Tengo followed suit. During the hour-long cremation, Tengo and Kumi waited in the building's lounge. Kumi bought two cans of hot coffee from the vending machine, and they silently drank them as they sat side by side on a bench, facing a large picture window. Outside was a spacious lawn, dried up now in the winter, and leafless trees. Two black birds were on one of the branches. Tengo didn't know what kind of bird they were. They had long tails, and though small, they gave loud, sharp squawks. When they called out, their tails stood on end. Above the trees was the broad, cloudless, blue winter sky. Beneath her cream-colored duffel coat, Kumi wore a short black dress. Tengo wore a black crewneck sweater under a dark gray herringbone jacket. His shoes were dark brown loafers. It was the most formal outfit he owned. "My father was cremated here, too," Kumi said. "All the people who attended were smoking like crazy. There was a cloud of smoke hanging up near the ceiling. Maybe to be expected, since they were all fishermen." Tengo pictured it. A gaggle of sunburned men, uncomfortable in their dark suits, puffing away, mourning a man who had died of lung cancer. Now, though, Tengo and Kumi were the only ones in the lounge. It was quiet all around. Other than an occasional chirp from the birds in the trees, nothing else broke the silence. No music, no voices. Peaceful sunlight poured in through the picture window and formed a taciturn puddle at their feet. Time was flowing leisurely, like a river approaching an estuary. "Thank you for coming with me," Tengo said after the long silence. Kumi reached out and put her hand on top of his. "It's hard doing it alone. Better to have somebody with you." "You may be right," Tengo admitted. "It's a terrible thing when a person dies, whatever the circumstances. A hole opens up in the world, and we need to pay the proper respects. If we don't, the hole will never be filled in again. Tengo nodded. The hole can't be left open, Kumi went on, or somebody might fall in.